Are you headed for a tea party tomorrow? Or are you one of the 88% of Democrats who approve of President Obama's performance? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We almost seem to have two nations in the same country these days. Has this really been going on for more than 40 years? Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll-free. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Nixonland is the subject on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Their mission is to advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards to provide quality public education, supporting student achievement and local governance. Information at aasb.org.
Nixonland is a, I guess I'd call it a revisionist history book. It's volume two of three volumes that the third one's being written right now. By our guest today, Rick Perlstein, joins us from Chicago. Rick, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Glad to be here.
Now, you, I guess, just stepped down. You were at, what, the Center for American Progress?
Oh, that's an easily confused thing. It's Campaign for America's Future.
Uh-huh.
It's another Washington-based liberal think tank. I was blogging for them about half-time for the last 2 years or so.
So we know where you're coming from politically, which was kind of my point.
That's true. I am a liberal without any apology.
Yeah. And so here you write a book about Richard Nixon, and you call it Nixon Land. But it's not really so much about Nixon as about the electorate in which he swam, I guess we would say.
That's exactly it.
And you're, you know, I said 40 years in introducing it, but I guess you see this idea of a severely divided country actually going back even before that.
Well, I think America has always been a severely divided country. I mean, if you think about it, we were formed with two different kinds of economies. One was this kind of agricultural economy that was, you know, based on slave labor. One was this industrial economy based on wage labor. And of course, by 1860, these two economies couldn't even live together. We had this awful civil war where, you know, over 600,000 people died. So we always have these profound undercurrents of disagreement within the American project. And my fascination is, you know, how we cope with it, how we deal with it, how we argue with each other, how we try and muddle through despite our differences. And I think that the 60s were not sort of the decade in which divisions in America began, but the ones that we're most familiar with now, the same kind of arguments have been kind of going on ever since Richard Nixon won that first presidential election in 1968 over the themes of, you know, law and order and arguing about the dangers of liberalism and that sort of thing.
The dangers of liberalism. Where do you think we are now?
Well, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, we are at a crossroads. You wake up in the morning, you open the newspaper, or you read your blogs, and what the future will look like is really very much up in the air. I mean, Barack Obama promised change, and whether he's going to be able to deliver on his program or not is, you know, an open question. But also an open question is whether we have put behind the divisions of the 60s, put them behind us. Certainly a big part of Barack Obama's vision for the country is to stop arguing about the things we've been arguing ever since the 60s, to put aside the angers and resentments of the baby boom generation, and to move forward to a new set of challenges. And I say, you know, it's an open question whether that's going to happen or not. So it's a very fascinating time to be an American citizen. You know, I mean, the idea that the old sort of red state, blue state divisions are behind us, you know, really seem to be vitiated by the fact that when he puts together this budget and doesn't get a single Republican vote, the divisions still seem pretty deep-seated.
Yeah, well, it does. And you saw probably the Pew Center's latest numbers, which show the biggest partisan gap in the modern era, with Obama's approval at 88% in Democrats and only 27% in Republicans.
Right, and a lot of that is just kind of self-sustaining. It's almost like spectral. Like if you ask a lot of Republicans who are, you know, listening to Fox or listening to Rush Limbaugh, they'll say, "Oh, Barack Obama is bringing us to this disastrous apocalyptic socialism." And you'll say, "Well, why? Well, what's he doing?" And they'll say, "He's raising taxes." And you'll say, "Well, he's raising taxes to where they were during the Reagan administration." And they'll say, "Oh, well, he said that he wants to see a world without nuclear weapons." And you say, "Well, that's what Ronald Reagan said, too, when he went to Reykjavik." So a lot of this stuff is not based on any kind of objective reality of what Barack Obama has in mind. It's almost this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy in which we've gotten kind of locked into this culture in which we have to see, conservatives have to see anything Barack Obama does as apocalyptic. And liberals have found it all too easily to find anything that the Republicans do as apocalyptic. So it's almost like we're running on fumes. These kinds of angers, these kinds of divisions aren't necessarily reflecting what's really going on the ground. It's become almost a culture unto itself. And that culture is what I call Nixonland.
Well, the book is 748 pages. It's probably, for some people, might be a tedious read because that's
Don't
more
say that.
That's more history than a lot of people. Well, plus it's only volume two. It's more history than a lot of people would just as soon wade through. But your basic point for the 60s would seem to be that there was a revolution that was less of a revolution than the revolutionaries thought it was.
Well, it's true that young people and minorities who thought that they were sort of ushering in this new Jerusalem, first of all, they didn't win. Richard Nixon won. Ronald Reagan won. The idea that the 60s were going to kind of usher in this brave new world in which, you know, all the old ways of doing things, you know, were put behind us, it seemed like that at the time. It definitely seemed like that at the time. But there was also another big element, and what it's called in the book and what it was called at the time was, you know, there was a backlash. There was a backlash against liberalism. There was a backlash against rapid social change. There was a backlash against the disruption of the civil rights movement. And people who, politicians who were able to speak that language of backlash in a convincing new way, people like Nixon, people like Reagan, ended up inheriting the political future. It wasn't people like George McGovern. It wasn't people like Tom Hayden. It wasn't people like Abby Hoffman. You know, we still experienced profound changes in those days. And, you know, even Republicans, if you really ask them honestly, wouldn't want to go back to the days, for example, when, you know, women weren't allowed to speak up in law school classes. They, you know, were only allowed to talk on Ladies' Day once a year, you know. And that change, for example, is very much a product of the 60s feminist movement, of the social movements. A lot of those changes we really take for granted. But the picture is very complex. One of the things that happened in the 70s was, and beginning in the 60s, was this absolute upsurge in conservative religion, in evangelical religion, in Orthodox religion. So you see this simultaneous breakdown of traditional norms and this flight to traditional norms at the same time. And that's kind of been the driving energy of the way Americans have tried to live together over the last 40 years or so.
Well, if we're running on the fumes of this red-hot struggle of the 1960s still, what? How can we get out of this?
It's an excellent question.
Well, I've tried a few areas that we've explored on this show down through the years. We had a guy by the name of Lou Feldstein on, who was co-author of a book called Better Together. And this is going on the bowling alone paradigm of social capital.
Right.
And he said, well, actually, when you go out and look in the communities, the people actually are getting along. You just have to go out there and look for it.
Huh. Well, I would argue myself as, you know, a liberal social democrat that the best way to put some of our divisions behind us is to create a more secure economy. I mean, a lot of the reason people are so anxious and feel so ready to see their neighbors as dispossessing them is because there's just so much economic insecurity. So much of us are in debt. So much of us, you know, we're hornswoggled into mortgages we couldn't afford. So many of us are experiencing levels of inequality that this country hasn't known since the 1920s, that erodes trust. And, you know, one of the things that happened in the 1980s and the 1990s, for example, was corporations literally, you know, stole their employees' pensions from out from under their employees. And one of the ways that was able to happen was because Republicans very skillfully used people's anxieties about the cultural changes that were going on to entrench themselves into power and often use that power to do things that really worked against the interests of the working man, of ordinary folks. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when liberalism was high in the saddle from, say, the New Deal, from actually the end of World War II until 1980, the actual living standards of the average American doubled. So if we get back to that idea that a social democratic government can provide a much more secure income floor for people, make people's work pay, because that's one of the things we've seen in the last 20 years under Republican control, is that productivity has gone up but wages have gone down, people will have a heck of a lot less to fight about.
Well said. Well said.
And I think in a lot of ways that's what Barack Obama is trying to do. And in some ways, he's not trying to do it enough. I mean, he seems much too friendly with these bankers who got us into the mess. So, you know, we got a lot of work ahead of us.
Our guest is Rick Perlstein, author of Nixon Land. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. Turning to the election, what do you think was, how did Nixon Land play out in the last election? It was a substantial victory for Mr. Obama.
That's right, but you saw just about every day people saying that Barack Obama was, you know, a socialist. You know, people saying that Barack Obama was a secret Muslim. People saying that Barack Obama maybe had this taste for white women like Paris Hilton. You see that sort of very sort of culturally loaded sort of anger politics that Richard Nixon really mastered. The idea that there's this silent majority that's being dispossessed by this sort of elitist, you know, sort of liberal fringe. You know, that was really a story that Richard Nixon and later Ronald Reagan sold so successfully to the country. And, of course, you know, Alaska makes a huge cameo with the figure of Governor Palin, who really was a figure straight out of Nixon land. I mean, her entry onto the scene could have read about her in my book. She was very much like a figure like Spiro Agnew, you know, arguing strenuously that this liberal elite was, you know, trying to steal your birthright. And that sort of panic is straight out of the political playbook of the right in the 1960s.
You know what's fascinating about her is that she seems to provoke such strong emotions from people. Even now, I mean, here in Alaska, we're watching it. There's a lot of polarization going on here. And it hasn't really lessened. It maybe even has gotten more. But it seems that for a lot of liberals, she just like rubs them terribly the wrong way, and they will tend to overreact. But overreaction seems to be what launches us into this polarization.
Well, and the overreaction, of course, helps the politics of someone like Sarah Palin, who relies on basically creating this kind of shrieking, hysterical response from liberals in order to be able to say, you see, they're shrieking and hysterical. Right? And, you know, a big part of, you know, Sarah Palin's appeal to those who love her is her, you know, her religion and her piety. And one of the tragic flaws in liberalism, especially in the 60s and 70s, I'd like to think that liberals are much better at dealing with this these days, is this kind of patronization towards these questions of faith and family. And the fact of the matter is, you know, there are plenty of liberals who are Christian, there are plenty of Christians who are liberals. But one of the things the Republicans have been able to do, because there have been always been enough kind of liberals that were kind of looking down their noses at devout Christians, is say, you see, they're laughing at you. You know, they basically look at you as a bunch of hicks, as a bunch of yokels. And we certainly saw that dynamic playing out in the campaigning of McCain and Palin in 2008. Although, to be true, it wasn't precisely successful. The Democrats, on a in a lot of ways, a very traditional message of liberal renewal, were able to prevail, and a lot of that had to do also with Barack Obama's excellent skills in speaking to all sorts of Americans and saying, "I respect your faith." But then again, there was a very famous moment, if you'll recall, during the convention during the campaign, when Barack Obama was speaking privately to a bunch of rich folks in San Francisco. And he gave a speech about how rural folks, people in middle America, were clinging to their guns and religion because they felt so much economic insecurity. And the way he said that was sufficiently infelicitous that it made it seem like religion wasn't something he respected. Now, I believe that he misspoke. I believe that he deeply respects religion. But that was enough to kind of fire the Republican troops for another couple of months.
So what do you think happened in the 60s? One thing that, you know, having lived through it, I was shocked at all the stuff that I had forgotten. You know, I certainly remembered the Frank Rizzo's raid on the Black Panthers. But some of those
and
other...
I'll string them up by their toes or something like that.
Yeah.
Within the law, I mean.
I kind of have forgotten all the other raids on the Black Panthers. And
You're in Chicago. They actually, the police and the FBI cooperated to literally murder a Black Panther in cold blood.
So the lesson out of this, and you point this out in your last chapter, is that when one side starts seeing evil in the other side, it can really lead all the way to homicide.
Absolutely, it did on both sides. I mean, one of our cultural memories of the 60s is that a lot of people on the New Left, a lot of the people in the anti-war movement, not a lot, but some people in the anti-war movement did, in fact, turn to violence. That was another big part of the 2008 campaign, this recollection of this guy, Bill Ayers, who, you know, had been at some meetings with Barack Obama, who literally, during 1969 and 1970, had done things like, you know, set bombs to try and end the Vietnam War. What we don't remember, and what I tried to recover in my book, is that even earlier, and with even greater intensity, there was a ton of right-wing vigilante violence against the left, against the anti-war movement. You know, I tell the story of how in 1966 in Richmond, Virginia, and I only was able to learn about this because I stumbled across it and reading the microfilm of the Richmond, Virginia newspaper, two anti-war activists in 1966 were passing out anti-Vietnam War leaflets downtown. And the next day they were discovered in a ditch with 10 bullets through their head. In the end of the same year, 1966, the police raided a warehouse in Queens where right-wing vigilantes were stockpiling grenades and machine guns and getting ready to attack left-wing retreats. So that sort of anger was it was so deep-seated. That sort of division was so deep-seated. And you saw it publicly in something, say, in 1970, like the shooting of the four students at Kent State University. Four anti-war activists basically shot down in cold blood by the National Guard, but by the same token, the students had only recently burned down a building on campus.
Right.
You literally had like a civil war in the streets of an American city.
Yeah, there was excesses going on very much on the left. I mean, some of these campus takeovers, burning down buildings, college officials just knuckling under ridiculously. How could that not provoke middle America to watch that?
Exactly. So, and there was a real arrogance on the part of the left that basically, well, we young people are the sort of the voice of the future, and our energy is going to, you know, usher in a new way of seeing things, and you know, the Woodstock generation is going to take over. You know, and we're going to
use the Hells Angels for security too.
Yeah, that was next. Yeah, that was at Altamont, right? But, you know, I mean, one thing, you know, I mean, the reason we're still, I think, you know, sort of drafting off these fumes from the 1960s and our own conception of what's right and what's wrong in politics is because it was such a violent, such a divisive time. And we really have yet to reckon with how profoundly traumatic that time was.
But, you know, I think the challenges for our time right now are really much greater, you know, environmentally. Just challenges culturally of all sorts.
We can't afford to bicker over this 40-year-old stuff.
You wouldn't think. Let's go to Dillingham and Stephen. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stephen.
Hi. I'm sorry I missed the name of your guest, but she was saying a few minutes ago that conservatives are complaining about Obama because he's raising taxes to the level they were under Reagan and reducing nuclear weapons to the level they were under Reagan. I'm just a little bit too young to remember Reagan, so I'll have to kind of take you on your word at that. But I think that conservatives' biggest criticism of Obama is the increased government spending he's taken to a completely unprecedented level, and it's utterly unsustainable. In the future, there's going to have to be either a huge increase in taxes or some sort of a, I don't know, but the level of government spending that Obama has brought us to is, it's completely unprecedented, and I think it's going to become a big problem.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of coming from a talking point of view, but that doesn't mean that it is not a concern.
Well, it is a concern, but it's also not true. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we have a big conservative media who has an enormous stake in, you know, keeping alive this sense that Barack Obama is the most profligate spender we've ever had as a president. That's not true. The biggest deficits we've ever had as a president were under George W. Bush. If you recall, under Bill Clinton, when he was president, we ended his term with a surplus. We had extra money lying around, and George Bush squandered it. So, you know, a big part of this whole Disneyland way of seeing the world.
Go ahead, Stephen.
You cannot honestly say George Bush never had a $1 trillion deficit. I don't know if he, I mean, I don't know what the highest deficit he ever had was, but it was never close to a trillion. And now I think we're already over a trillion in halfway through April.
Go ahead, Rick.
No large part of that is
that's Stephen, Rick Perlstein.
Stephen, you know that when Bill Clinton stopped being president, we had a surplus, right? We had more money in the public treasury. How do you think that happened?
I don't know. Explain me.
Well, I'll explain it to you. Basically, one of the problems with the way Republicans run government, with all due respect, is that they always say, oh, let's cut this, let's cut that, let's cut that, and then we won't have any more deficits. But we always end up with bigger deficits. Well, why is that? That's because the government has to do certain things. We live in a complex modern society, and we can't get along without government. So basically what they do is starve, they starve the instruments of government, and it ends up, we still have to do the same amount of stuff, but we can't do it efficiently. We can't do it, we can't meet the needs of the people. And it dismays me, the idea to hear that you think that Barack Obama is, you know, introducing these unprecedented sorts of deficits, because it's, you know, simply not true. I mean,
he had a simple number for you there, though, Rick. He said $3 billion, $3 trillion.
He said a trillion.
Yes.
And the reason we have these profound deficits is because they were inherited from George W. Bush. And I don't mean to blame George W. Bush. I just mean to say that the idea of deficits never became a problem for a lot of Republicans until there was a Democrat who was in office. And that's sort of, you know, sort of knee-jerk, oh, it's a Democrat, so he's going to, you know, he's going to bring some awful future to America.
Taxing and spending.
It's just the kind of thing we can't afford. And the fact of the matter is, and when I say fact, I mean fact, is that spending over Barack Obama is going to be about at the same level it was under Ronald Reagan, 23% of the gross domestic product.
Okay, well, that's Stephen, thank you for making that point. I think you have a genuine concern.
I could argue about this all day, but
Steve, I'm a man.
Take more callers.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh,
all right.
Sorry.
It's all right. Thank you very much, Stephen, for your call. Let's go to Greg. Joins the program from Hoonah. Greg, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call again. I just don't see that there's. I think this has been an orchestrated effort. By both administrations, and they're taking us down the path of bankruptcy. And they have a plan, and the plan is to bring us into a global money system. And they're gonna, in the future, you're gonna see America go bankrupt according to their plan. And then they're gonna issue in the Amero, and they're gonna hold the Amero up in your bank, and they're gonna go, well, the dollar's dropping like a rock out of the sky. The Amero is holding
Amero?
Steady. What do you want to do, people? And
okay, what's the Amero?
The Amero is their proposed new dollar for the Western Hemisphere.
Oh, I see. So it'd be like Amero. A euro, but it would be a Western Hemisphere. Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
And then they'll mesh the euro with the Amero, and they'll have their global money system of the Western Hemisphere. And China doesn't want this. Russia doesn't want this. So they're talking about forming their own banks now. And but if
what's your evidence for this?
Go ahead.
What's your evidence for this?
Oh, there's tons. I've forecasted this 30 years ago, and all my friends told me I was crazy. It's not. If you understand the way, you know, back in the days of ore, we had kings. Well, those people and that mentality has never gone away. Those kings now is King Rothschild, King Rockefeller. You know, you name them, and they still want. Global, they still want to control all the people in their kinghood. And that mentality
sounds like gibberish to me, I'm afraid.
Has been around for eons, and you will never destroy that sickness.
Okay, but...
Certain people just have to control the rest of us, and if we allow them, they will do it.
Okay, Greg, well, what's the answer?
The answer is what David Kucinich is trying to... He was on the House floor for an hour. And he educated the House members, and now...
You mean Dennis Kucinich?
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich, excuse me. And for an hour, he told people the history of our banking system and what went wrong and how to fix it. And that is the only way to get us out of this system.
Well, we're certainly going to have to do something about the financial services industry because it's become a joke.
Well, it's the hugest Ponzi scheme ever perpetrated upon the American, and now it's being perpetrated upon the world.
So, what do you think? Should we privatize Social Security, Greg?
Oh well, that's a whole different thing. I just one step at a time. I'm not
okay.
There's a lot of people that are smarter.
But I want to know where this word Amero comes from.
The Amero.
Who coined it?
Oh,
never heard that before. I've heard of the Euro, but I've never heard of the Amero.
Then you're not in the know.
Oh, you heard it first here, man.
You need to educate yourself as far as you know, follow the money.
All right.
You follow the 200 or 300 multi-billionaires of the world that meet in secret places of the world, and you, it's their agenda.
Greg, thank you so much. Greg from Hoonah. Our guest is Rick Perlstein. He's author of Nixon Land as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, author Ben Michelson and the young people who read his books through the Alaska Spirit of Reading Project. Talk about a change of subject. Our guest is Rick Perlstein. He's author of Nixon Land. He joins us from Chicago. Nixon Land has only been out, what, a couple of months now, 3 months?
No, it's been out a year, and actually just today is the publication date of the paperback. So you can get a nice, cheap, lightweight edition of Nixon Land. Just head to the bookstore or to Amazon.com.
It's I would say, an exhaustive history of a period, a part of American's history, which is, would you call it revisionist? Seems revisionist to me.
I think all good history is revisionist in the sense that we're always using kind of new information and coming up with new evidence and reading evidence in light of contemporary experience. So, in the sense that it is revisionist in that most previous histories of the 60s really have emphasized things like, you know, the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, whereas I emphasize the backlash against those things because it's the backlash that eventually ended up, you know, taking control of the country in the form of people like Nixon and Reagan. But, you know, revisionist is also, that can mean apathetic, can be an insult that's thrown around, which means, you know, some politically motivated history that, you know, isn't scrupulous about the facts and the evidence. And I'd like to think that I'm very scrupulous about the facts and the evidence.
My dream show would have been to have you on with Kevin Phillips.
Oh, that would be great.
And just kind of see what happened.
Kevin Phillips was one of the people I interviewed for the book.
Yeah. One of the things that you do in this book is show us what Karl Rove was doing as part of the little dirty tricks operation that Nixon had going in the Watergate era. Amazing.
That's right.
I'd never heard that before.
Yeah. Karl Rove was a young Republican activist. He was an activist in the Young Republicans, college Republicans, and he was a real hotshot. And he was hired to help a campaign in Illinois for state attorney general. He was hired by the Republican who was running against a guy named Al Dixon, who later became a Democratic senator. And he instituted or introduced into this campaign some of the dirty tricks that the Young Republicans had been using in their own sort of college elections. What he did was he pretended to be a volunteer for the Democrat, stole the Democrats' stationery and logo, and made up a fake invitation. Basically, the Democrat was having a reception, an opening reception for his new campaign office. It was a black tie reception. And what Karl Rove did was he faked an invitation saying it said something like, there's going to be free booze, there's going to be chicks there. And he distributed these fake invitations all over the Skid Rows of Chicago. So when the day came and they had this black tie reception with all the media there, all these derelicts and hobos and hippies showed up. And the idea was to discredit the Democrat in the eyes of the public, to basically imply that this is the kind of people that any Democrat attracts. And that very much was, and soon after that, he got a job at the Republican National Committee to help, you know, teach his techniques to the National Republicans. And those sorts of tricks are very much what we mean when we talk about Watergate. That's what the Richard Nixon presidential campaign in 1972 was called, CREEP, the Committee to Reelect the President, almost kind of institutionalized across the country. These attempts to discredit the Democrats through various sorts of cheating and dirty tricks.
Well, it seemed like they almost...
But Nixon had to resign over.
It seems like they almost drove Ed Muskie crazy.
They did almost drive Ed Muskie crazy. That little business was from the White House. A man sent a letter to a New Hampshire newspaper, and he claimed that Muskie had used an ethnic slur. He claimed to be an ordinary citizen. Of course, he was really a White House staffer, and that was reported. And it looked like Edmund Muskie was this terrible racist, but it was all kind of drummed up by this, you know, secret White House behind-the-scenes campaign. And he got so angry, and he lost control in the speech. And it was snowing, and some people thought he cried during the speech. Some people think that it was just snow running down his nose. And that really discredited him in the eyes of the electorate. He was the favorite. he had an excellent chance against Richard Nixon. He was a Democratic centrist. He had wide and broad support. And basically, the White House took it upon himself to try and sabotage his campaign so they could run against a more a candidate who was less sympathetic to the public. It's an extraordinary business.
Well,
and then, of course, during 1973 and 1974, if people will remember, all this stuff came out. The Watergate hearings on TV, you know, you had people admitting to these things, and it was a profound trauma for the nation to realize that this kind of stuff was going on in the world's greatest democracy.
Well, all of this stuff came out, but and yet the extent of it, I was reading for the first time, really, in your book.
Well, it's, you know, I got this all from lots of different books about Watergate. People forget about it. You know, people don't want to remember it. I mean, it's traumatic. I mean, we'd like to think that our leaders are better than this. But Richard Nixon was a very ruthless fellow. And he bequeathed some very bad habits upon the Republican Party. You know, not saying the Democrats are completely innocent. But when I gave a speech about the bad influence of Richard Nixon on the Republicans and the conservative movement and their willingness to kind of do anything to win, one of the conservatives who had heard the speech said afterwards, well, I didn't like Nixon until Watergate. There's this positive identification with the idea that, well, the enemy is going to do it first, so we have to do it to them before they do it to us. And, you know, we saw a lot of that with Karl Rove and Jack Abramoff, And it's a very sad, tragic entailment of Nixon's time in the White House.
You know, at the center of it, this idea of the preemptive strikes and everything is if you believe that your opponent is evil, then it almost inevitably draws you towards being evil.
Nixon always thought that he was acting on defense. He always thought he had to do it to the Democrats before the Democrats did it to him. Now, that was his paranoia speaking. He was a very paranoid man. And he helped produce a very paranoid country.
Let's go to Rex. Joins the program from Galena. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Rex.
Good morning. Enjoying the conversation very, very much so. And referencing Nixon as a paranoid man, how about that last caller? It seemed pretty paranoid to me, the Amaro.
Well, he's figuring it out. He's doping it out as best he can. I mean, it's not the only person that's got a conspiracy theory about the Rothschild family and the Illuminati and all that. The Rosicrucians.
Dennis Kucinich, that's okay with me. I'm a big admirer of Dennis Kucinich.
So, anyway, Rex, what was that your business also? You want to talk about currency?
No, I just wanted to comment on that. Then that seems to be the. I don't know if you would call it a cause and effect or what exactly the situation is. It's always people come out of the woodwork and cast fear and go for these crazy tactics like you were just mentioning about Nixon being completely paranoid. And it makes me wonder if people are really that out there or if it's some kind of plant. So I don't know if I have a conspiracy theory about a conspiracy theory.
Well, look, this is the way I see it, Rex, and I've been thinking about this for a long time. Why are so many Americans so quick to believe that there's a small group of people behind the scenes who want to control their lives? And one of the reasons I come up with is, you know, Americans grow up to believe that they live in, if not a democracy, at least a democratic republic. We believe that we're a government of the people, for the people, by the people. But as a matter of fact, there's a lot of aspects of the American system that aren't particularly democratic. I mean, in order to pass anything in the Senate, you need 60 votes.
Right.
You know, it's easy to block stuff. You can bottle stuff up in committee. You know, powerful interest groups can muddy the waters through by buying television commercials and things like that. And I think all that frustration of the democratic will has a very sad and tragic cumulative effect. I think if we were a democracy in which all you needed was 50% to get something passed, and the government would be a lot more responsive to the wishes of the people, and people wouldn't be throwing their hands up in the air and saying the government is stealing our birthright, the government is dispossessing us, because the government would be a lot closer to our will.
Rex?
And I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think that's a very valid point.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that there is a tendency in talk radio to certainly not this show, but There's a lot of talk radio that just thrives on all sorts of conspiracy theories. I mean, it really, and it's fun, you know.
It's fun. You know, it's a lot more interesting to think that, you know, first of all, the world is comprehensible. You know, it's like if there's just a small group of people who control everything, well, you know, that's a lot more comforting than the thought that basically no one's in control. And there aren't, you know, like 300 billionaires who are controlling everything. In fact, you know, as powerful as billionaires are, they have a hard time controlling their own lives, you know?
And that seems to be what happened in the financial services industry, is that nobody realized that all these fancy derivatives and so forth were really about nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea...
Even the people that were doing it didn't understand what it was.
Right, so the idea that they're in control of anything is difficult to comprehend. I don't think anyone benefits from the kind of chaos we're seeing in the financial sector. Lots of people are losing their billions.
Yeah, so but then you get, but really then you get your Bernie Madoff, you know, who just runs in there and makes off with a bunch of money.
But now he's in jail.
Yeah, well, that's true. Rex, thanks for your call from Galena.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right, let's go to Sean now down in Heidelberg. Sean, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Rick Perlstein.
Hi. Thank you, Steve. I'd just like to tell you, I'm 55 years old. I got arrested as a junior in upstate New York trying to protest the war in high school. And the local paper, the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, labeled us as students, the SDS, which we didn't even know what they were. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed the
war.
Show.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's an excellent example of America's democracy failing its people. I mean, there was an enormous amount of dispossession in that you had this war that was very unpopular. It didn't have popular support. And the government could literally snatch a young person in the prime of life and send them halfway across the world for this war that no one seemed to believe in. I mean, the 1960s... Put him in jail, right?
Yeah. And boy, did I get in trouble? Oh my God!
So yeah, Sean, are you from Heidelberg or?
No, I'm from upstate New York. I've been in Alaska since November of 1971.
Oh wow!
I came up here in the Army. I went to Fort Greeley.
Well, tell me this:
my wife up north, and I've been in Heidelberg ever since.
So, were you born and raised up around Rochester?
Yes, I was.
You know that the Underground Railroad went right through there, don't you?
Yes, I do. And there's a real good book that I just seen on A&E that was just published recently about the Underground Railroad and the all the underground things that were in different cities that people had to sleep in closets and
yeah,
go through tunnels and everything. But
well, they're very, anyway, very, very proud heritage in that part of the country. You know, I know it well, and it's been many religious reforms have sprung up from that particular part of New York State.
Well, my wife and kids are Haida, and I'm very proud of their heritage. And I just like to say I've heard of this Amaro before with other friends, and I Googled it after I heard the gentleman from Dillingham or from Huna, and there are 1,500 hits.
Whoa.
On Amaro.
You know, that's not that much.
You can buy Amaro right now at AmaroCurrency.com.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Gold. You don't even have to go to Second Life. That's incredible.
It's something that, you know, you talk about conspiracy, and what's that late-night talk show?
Art Bell, maybe?
Yeah. Well, we don't get that here, but... You know, every night somebody comes up with something. But this Amaro is for real, and I just like to bring it up to the listeners.
All right, Sean. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for your show.
I could make up a word right here on the air and get 1,500 Google hits for it by tomorrow.
All right. Well, go for it. It's all right. I'll give you a moment to think of it. No, seriously, Rick, one thing you document in your book, Nixon Land, is that the media was frequently clueless. I mean, even when it came to Watergate.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, there were just these sort of blotter stories that show up on page 6.
Yeah.
You know, it took quite a while.
It is a fact that, you know, people in the elite try and protect each other, and they don't They don't like the idea of their own kind being unmasked for their mistakes. And yeah, in the New York Times, the idea that the Attorney General and the President were involved in a conspiracy to break into the Democratic headquarters, which is what Watergate was all about, was just too awful to contemplate. And you saw a lot of the media basically looking the other way. And that's one of the great dramas of this period. And Woodward and Bernstein, of course, are the famous ones who, later wrote All the President's Men. There was a movie about it with Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford. They showed a lot of courage. And one of the reasons they were able to show that courage was because they were kind of outsiders. They weren't the big White House correspondents. They were police correspondents for the Washington Post. And people were laughing at them. Why are you paying attention to this silly story? And of course, at the end, they were vindicated. And that kind of vigilance is something to which all American citizens should aspire, I think.
Well, I think if the same thing were to happen today, the performance of the media would be even worse.
That may well be the case. Well, it did happen. I mean, basically, you. Had a literal government conspiracy to convince people that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, that Saddam Hussein had biological weapons. This was a conspiracy hatched in the White House to try and convince Americans of something that was not true in order to advance a certain policy that they wanted, which was a war with Iraq. And they were quite successful in convincing, I think, the majority of Americans something that simply wasn't true.
Well, you still according to the latest Pew Center poll, you have I forget the percentage, was a huge percentage of people who say that they are Christians who also believe still that Barack Obama is a Muslim.
Isn't that sad? I mean, isn't that sad? It's propaganda. And,
so it seems like we're going...
How often does a guy have to go to church, not be a Muslim,
Well, it seems what I'm saying is it seems like we're going in the wrong direction. All the wheels are moving in, you're rotating the wrong way.
Well, the media worries me. I mean, a lot of the political reporters in Washington, they're so attached to this idea that they have to be scrupulously fair to Republicans and Democrats that when the Republicans lie, they won't call them on the lie. Because then that would make them seem to have a liberal bias. And, you just have to tell the truth without fear or favor. And when someone lies, you have to call them a liar. And
What is happening is that basically those type of breakthroughs are made on the web now.
They're made on the web. That's right. And that's one of the reasons why the big chat reporters are so quick to disparage the web. And, of course, there's lots of nonsense out on the web. I think the Samero thing is nonsense. But one of the reasons there's been such a fluorescence of citizen journalism is because the powerful journalists have not always done such a good job. I mean, with the Iraq War and with the lies told by the White House, they became the conduits of the lies instead of the debunker of the lies. And, that's really something that Americans need to look hard at.
Well, you probably heard the name Ann Kilkenny. She wrote a... basically just an email to some friends in the lower 48 about Sarah Palin, and it went viral. And it was picked up by many different sources. She recently gave a speech at the Alaska Press Club, and she said something really interesting. She said, "Do not spread fear of the public." She felt that the media accounts of what happened to her, the backlash against her for this email that went viral was not as bad as the media wanted to make it seem.
Mm. Well, the media has a vested interest in being interesting, in creating drama. So we all have to be critical, and we all have to think twice about, what's their interest in all this? To be titillating often. And that always doesn't always serve the public interest either.
Rick, we're just not getting a good traction on this is how we're going to regain and restore our civic common ground, are we?
Well, Americans always manage to muddle through.
Muddling
and
through.
We're still a prosperous nation. We're still a free nation. And I think will remain so for the imaginable future. I have a lot of faith in the future.
Rick Perlstein is our guest on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The book is Nixon Land. It talks about how this division that we see in our country now actually has roots that go deep into the past, way back. I guess if you were to read Gary Wills, he would say it's always been here in this country. You've always had the Tories and the Whigs, or the slave-holding states, and the so-called free states, the industrial states, and the agricultural, and so forth. And maybe we're just seeing the same drama played out over and over again, Rick.
I think that conflict is written into the American DNA. I mean, that's just a fact. And what behooves us to do is realize that there's always going to be conflicts in America. Don't have this kind of glib fantasy that we can all sort of just get along if we all put aside our differences. We have to learn how to argue with each other in a civil way. You know, as long as the arguments go on with mutual respect and without violence, we shouldn't disparage argument for its own sake. We have to argue with each other because.
But it seems like we're very rhetorically insecure. You know,
right? I think so.
Like right now, yeah. Right now we have this teabag thing going on. Well, if you know anything about how all this works, this is all completely interest groups that put this teabag thing together, and yet people who fear for their savings and so forth. You know, will tomorrow be going to the federal buildings and so forth, and, you know, using that particular form of rhetoric because that's all they've got.
Well, yeah, and you're doing what you need to do, which is basically expose the truth. Sometimes the truth outs, and someone within range of your voice will hear, oh, my God, this really is being paid for by Bank of America and all these right-wing think tanks, and this isn't this grassroots upsurge. Maybe I should give it a second thought. And that's all you can do, really. I mean, all you can do is, you know, fight lies with truth.
Let's go to Helen, joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Helen.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to share what my grandpa predicted. I was 5 when he died. He was like 105.
Whoa.
And what he told me was... he already knew there was going to be, like, global warming and our climate will change. And he said that we'll start talking about issues that affect all of us, from animal rights to animals to people. I know exposing the truth together is healthy, but when we start doing it individual, he said that it wouldn't be helping us as citizens in our country, you know, in this world.
So we should seek to speak together? Is that what he was getting at?
Yeah, that's how our ancestors did it for centuries. You know, they gathered and they talk about issues together. And now everything is individualized, personal. It's personalized, and it's different.
And, well, I think we do need to gather together and talk about these things. And no one is served by people just retreating into their individual shells.
Yes.
It's okay to talk about somebody if it's right. Like they did something wrong, it's okay, because we need to hold people responsible when they do something. But I'm proud of President Obama, and I'm so happy we have a black person, and not we always had Caucasians for centuries being our leader. It's about time we have change, and we need to address issues together, not individual.
Helen, thank you, Helen. Thank you very much. Rick, what you're hearing there is that somewhat of a tribal point of view where mm-hmm. within the tribe there's protocols for how things are brought up and are not.
Yeah.
And
fascinating.
Yeah. Well, You say you've just started on volume 3 and you're only going to take up to 1980?
Yes, that's right.
So let's see. The first one is about, it was pretty much the Goldwater.
That's right. That went from 58 to 64.
And
you go from 65 to 72. And I'm going to go from 73 to 80. And then I'm going to retire to Florida or something.
Yeah, on your massive royalties from our publishing industry.
Well, knock on wood. Everyone needs to run out and get a copy at Amazon right now to help my future.
Nixon Land, now out in paperback.
Excellent.
Well, yeah, on this Goldwater thing, it seems in a lot of ways that the problem that we got into in Nixon Land and ended up with Reagan Land started in Goldwater Land.
Yeah.
In the sense that there was such scorn, it was such a landslide for Lyndon Johnson. And
yeah.
And it's almost as if the liberals got too cocky and thought
Absolutely.
That they'd stomp the conservatives into the ground forever.
Absolutely.
And you had this Young Americans for Freedom that was almost a joke at the time that later on ends up running the country.
That's absolutely true. And there's a real object lesson for liberals in there, which is that there'll always be conservative sentiments in the country. And the idea that you can just sort of impose the kind of policies you'd like to see from above without having democratic, as they say, buy-in from the rest of the country, that's just going to bite you in the rear end eventually. So the work is never completed of trying to kind of create popular legitimacy for the kind of policies you'd like to see. And Lyndon Johnson wasn't always good at that. And people felt, people felt like things like urban renewal happened without any kind of democratic process.
Do you think the internet is you were blogging, you were trying to help probably mm-hmm. Obama here as we rolled up into the campaign. Do you think blogging is a way out? I mean, right now some think it's making things worse, some think it's making things better. Where do you come down on it?
Well, I mean, I see blogging fundamentally as it's a medium like any other. I mean, it can be good, it can be bad, and it's up to us to basically be critical about what sources we read, just like we would want to be critical about what newspapers we read. I think it's great that the monopoly of information is being broken down, but we need to be very careful that we don't fall for irresponsible writing.
Well,
and that's
see,
true in any medium.
So we need to come up with our own spin on things, kind of like the guy with the Amaro.
I think that's nonsense.
Well, yeah, but at least it's a shot. I want to thank you so much for being with us. I'll let you get back to your book, Rick.
My pleasure. Hello, Alaska.
All right. Thank you. Rick Perlstein, author of Nixon Land. Thank you so much for being with us. Next week, Alaska Spirit of Reading with Ben Michelson, Dave Waldron on the controls, Len Anderson and Pat Yak on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.